Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Policy Agendas podcast. My name is EJ Fagan. Today I'm joined by my wonderful co-host Christine Bird.
Hey.
And Zach McGee.
Hello.
And our guest is Allison Craig, assistant professor of government here at the University of Texas at Austin and author of the new article just out in the American Journal of Political Science with her co-authors Janet Box Steffensmeyer. I apologize if I pronounced that incorrectly, and Dino Christensen. The article is called Q-Taking in Congress, Interest Group Signals from Dear Colleague Letters. Allison, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So can you just tell me a little bit about this article, Q-Taking in Congress, Interest Group Signals from Dear Colleague Letters? What's the argument that you guys make?
So our argument is that members of Congress are dealing with fairly limited resources, both in terms of time and their ability to just process the sheer amount of information that they're dealing, that they get on a daily basis. And so one of the ways that they deal with that kind of information overload, there are a number of ways that are discussed in the Congress literature, but one of them is specifically by taking cues from other actors, whether they are from other members of Congress or interest groups, which is what we focus on specifically in this paper. And we argue that cues from interest groups provide a strong signal to members of Congress when they're making decisions about legislation. And specifically, we argue that in the earliest stages of the legislative process, it's actually cues from groups that have a high degree of what we call social power, that have the most influence rather than the sheer number of groups.
All right. So why is this important? So why is it useful to know that these cues are being taken by members of Congress?
Sure. So, I mean, I think, you know, in political science, we spend a lot of time trying to identify the, you know, ways that interest groups affect the legislative process. We have this kind of prior expectation that the interest groups are actually very powerful and they're very influential, and the research on exactly where their influence is a little bit mixed. And so I think one of the important contributions of this paper is we are showing a very clear way that interest groups are influencing the legislative process. But we're also showing kind of the specifics about how those groups are influencing the legislative process. So if you think about our interest group social power measure, what we're saying with that is that groups that are more well-connected within the interest group community are more effective. Their endorsements for legislation carry more weight. And so that's actually, I mean, if we want to think about like prescriptive implications, that's actually something that interest groups can think about when trying to figure out how to be effective.
So the primary means that you're measuring this influence is through Dear Colleague Letters. And for someone who might not be familiar, can you explain what are these Dear Colleague Letters, what do the data look like, and all that?
Sure. So Dear Colleague Letters are letters sent by members of Congress within the House. Every member of Congress has the ability to send these letters. Almost all of them do. They are letters that are typically used to introduce legislation. About half of them are used to request co-sponsors for a bill. The remainder are used to solicit support for legislation or policy letters or events, invitation events. We focus very specifically on the letters that pertain to legislation because we're interested in the endorsements to bills. And so we start with about 100,000 letters.
It's a lot of letters.
It is a lot of letters. That consumed much of my career as a graduate student was coding and dealing with 100,000 Dear Colleague letters. Fun times.
What did they look like while you were coding them? What's the data format as?
So that's a fun story. So the data format, the original data format is that the letters, because I actually archived them when I was still working on the Hill, the letters were saved in a Microsoft Office PST file. That is not a file format that is remotely useful to anyone in any way, shape, or form. So first, they're all in email form, and that's why it's this Outlook PST. It's basically a giant Outlook mailbox. And so I had to take the individual emails and shift them over into the mbox format because there is a Python script that can actually handle mbox emails. And so I ran my script through all of these individual mbox files, extracted the necessary information, and ended up with a massive spreadsheet of data.
So they're not using LaTeX over there.
No, they are not using LaTeX on Capitol. They're still using WordPerfect in some offices.
You know how I feel about that.
So you see these dear colleague letters, and in some sense, you have a very kind of clean ask right here. You say they're requesting co-sponsors, most of them, or at least they're involving legislation, and you can evaluate that legislation and how many co-sponsors it gets. So I guess the really complicated part is then the independent variable, interest group social power. Mm-hmm. How is that measured?
So the interest group's social power actually draws on data that my co-authors, Jen Bock-Steffensmeyer and Dino Christensen, have been working on for a while and have put together. And it's based on interest groups signing amicus curiae briefs together. So they've actually identified the interest groups who sign these amicus curiae briefs before the Supreme Court together and then are able to create a network out of those signatures, where two interest groups that sign an amicus curiae brief together are connected within this larger interest group network. So if you envision the network as kind of the larger interest group community, two groups that sign letters together are connected. And then we measure it with something called the eigenvector centrality scores, which is a really fancy way of saying that we are accounting for not only the number of connections that an individual group has. So if I were to sit here and say, all right, well, I'm connected to the three of you because you're graduate students here at UT and we're in the Policy Agendas Project group together. And that would be a very simple way of measuring interest group or connections within a network. What eigenvector centrality does, it allows me to actually then weight how well connected you are. So my score goes up if I'm connected to other well-connected groups. And so that's why we argue that it's a measure of interest group social power.
Let's stop and ask some more specific questions about that now. So I think Christine has one.
So when we were talking about amicus curiae briefs, you state in the paper that the three of you think that this is a similar measure to what we would see in these interest groups in Congress. So, but the groups that would be signing an amicus curiae brief are going to be in the certain group that would be bringing cases before the Supreme Court. And then you have people like the soybean interest group. And they're probably not going to be filing an amicus curiae brief. So how do you pull them in to this larger network that you're talking about?
So they actually do sign amicus curiae briefs. That's actually the graph that we have in the paper that shows the network of the American Soybean Association is actually their connections through signing these amicus curiae briefs. Okay. So we have all of these groups, and a lot of them are, that was one of my kind of early questions when I'm thinking about this project, because I think that the groups that are going to sign these briefs are going to be very, like, justice oriented. And those certainly are in the groups, I mean, are in the list, like the ACLU is prominent in the network. But, you know, so is the National Education Association and the National Organization of Women. And
okay, so it's y'all's position that there is a lot of overlap and we're comfortable with that. That's great, because that means a lot less data collection for somebody else to do.
Yes.
So you heard it here. Amicus is just as important as other parts.
I mean, the main part of our argument is that the relationships that are formed between groups signing amicus curiae briefs together persist. The idea is that if two organizations are going to work together and coordinate on, you know, they have to agree on the language, they have to work out the details, they have to agree on the argument. That is actually, they're building a relationship. These are two groups that are building a relationship, and there's not really a reason to expect that it would just vanish once that we move on to a different project.
And I assume that any the errors that are left over from there would probably tend toward randomness. And so you're probably actually making it harder to reject a null hypothesis here.
Yes, yeah. Very much so.
All right, let's move on and talk a little bit more about some more specific theoretical questions. So, Zach, I think you wanted to ask about position taking.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I thought was really insightful that you guys talk about, right, is like if there are interest groups taking positions on every single bill in Congress, these signals would be significantly weaker. I think that's really important to keep in mind. But it also made me wonder, what is the variance of position taking among interest group populations, right? Like, are some interest groups just taking a handful, but the mean interest group is taking like 15 positions? Do you know anything about that side?
So we do look at interest group count, like the number of within the data set. We look at the number of times that interest groups endorse legislation. And I don't remember the exact statistics, but I think the range goes up to about 50. But the median is one. Wow. You know, most of these groups are signing, you know, one, maybe two, putting their name on one, maybe two. The ones that are signing or that are endorsing multiple pieces of legislation are really the big names that you would expect: the National Education Association, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, National Association of Manufacturers. They are signing... At that point, it's still only like 20 bills that they're endorsing, though.
Wow.
So this isn't within the context of these Dear Colleague letters.
Still, that's interesting. Huh?
Yeah, because it's a matter of these are endorsements that are solicited at the earliest stage of the legislative process. And I think that's really kind of the key distinction. We're not saying that the National Association of Manufacturers only endorses, you know, 20 bills in a given Congress. But if members are approaching them at kind of the earliest stages to get their support when they're first introducing something, it's much more limited.
Do you think that members will occasionally hold back endorsements if, say, it's a lefty group or a right-leaning group, just to not signal that that this is a left-leaning or right-leaning piece of legislation?
It's possible, but for the most part, these are actually endorsements that are solicited by the members. So the process can go in two different ways. So typically what you end up having is a member of Congress has an idea, they put together a proposal, and then they can perhaps shop it to some relevant interest groups to see if they'll support them. So if I'm a member and I want to do, if I'm a Democratic member and I want to introduce a major education bill, I'm going to shop it to the National Education Association and see what they think. And maybe they'll endorse it. At the very least, I want to make sure that they're not going to oppose it. So that's, you know, the endorsement's kind of a high ask in a lot of cases. In other cases, you'll have interest groups that approach members of Congress with, you know, here is the thing that we would like you to do. And then you have kind of a built-in endorsement, assuming that the member does as they ask. But, yeah.
So this process is really interesting and I think potentially counterintuitive for people. So this almost looks like reverse lobbying. So this is members of Congress asking interest groups for their endorsement rather than the other way around. And is that what you find, or do you think that this process leans more on one way or the other?
So we don't really, I won't say that our paper finds this, because that, you know, that's not something that we address in the paper. We don't do the research that would be needed to actually demonstrate that in a conclusive way. But I will say, based on qualitative data, I certainly think that's true. Based on my own experiences, I worked on Capitol Hill for a while. I think that's true. But also, we do a number of interviews with staff, and they describe a similar process of, you know, you have an idea, and one of the first things you want to do is see who you can get on board.
Have you read Barrow Poindexter's book on lobbying? 1963, old book.
No, I haven't.
So they did a big, you know, survey based kind of semi qualitative mm-hmm. study of it was like a piece of tariff legislation, and they went in expecting, and they say this in the book, kind of like an iron triangle relationship where interest groups are really telling members of Congress what to do and all that, and they've got this great quote from an anonymous senator who says, like, no, the interest groups aren't chasing me around, I'm chasing them around, like I'm trying to corral this coalition together, and that's kind of part of what I'm doing. I imagine that's something that these data in mm-hmm. another study could really illuminate. All right, so Christine, you wanted to ask a little bit about heuristics.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting normative consideration here about using Dear Colleague letters as a heuristic for whether or not other people are going to support this bill. So there's the potential that they support the bill from the Dear Colleague letter alone. There's the potential that they read the whole bill. Is this just a filtering mechanism to make people's lives in the House easier, or is this an abdication of responsibility?
I mean, I do think it, I think it's a filtering mechanism. And I think that when you consider the sheer number of bills that are introduced in a given Congress, and so on the House side, for example, if you have 6,000 or 7,000 bills, generally speaking, introduced in a 2-year period, and members of the House of Representatives are limited to 18 staff members, half of which are typically out in your district, you have 3 or 4 legislative staff members who have massive portfolios covering a wide variety of issues. And I mean, the reality is, you know, they're not going to be able to read every single bill that's introduced. And so I think that one of the real values of these Dear Colleague letters broadly, and specifically when these interest group endorsements come into play, is that when members send out these letters, it's a way to grab attention from a staff member who then continues to do research. So it's basically it's not as if they're not going to ever read the bill before they sign on to it. We're not suggesting that they're just signing on based purely on these Dear Colleague letters, so much as it's a way of drawing attention as you're filtering through dozens of these in a day.
So I think this connects back to the main theme of this paper, is that this is all about a signaling mechanism, which again relates to what your co-authors talked about in their work on amicus briefs. So this is a very similar process as before the Supreme Court. The people who are signing on to amicus briefs, whether it's the Solicitor General or these really powerful social power heavy interest groups, are showing support or not support for a piece of legislation, or whether it be in the court's context as a potential decision to be made. That's also a filtering mechanism. And so you can really see how social power can translate across these different institutions. And I think that's a really, really interesting contribution.
Absolutely. Thank you.
One of the, interesting descriptive things that you talk about with regard to the letters that I picked up on, you say that there's a negative correlation between letters that are listing interest groups and that are explicitly seeking co-signers or co-sponsorship? No, co-signers. And you attribute this to the quick turnaround of the letters, but
Keep talking. Right.
I was surprised by this, but why do you think a letter inviting a member to a reception or a letter to the administration is a stronger place to have a cue than a request for a co-signer specifically?
So I don't think we do suggest that. I think what you're seeing is that in the earliest, so first of all, we actually filter out the letters that have to deal with policy letters and invitations, anything that's not dealing with bills. So what we're left with are the letters that are recruiting co-sponsors and the letters that are urging support or opposition on the floor, which is actually a surprisingly small number of letters in the whole data set. So these letters really are used to draw attention at the earliest stages of the legislative process, more so than that kind of end stage lobbying where you have a lot more, once the bill has been filtered down, once the bill has been survived the winnowing process and is one of the few things that is actually being considered on the floor, members have a lot more time to do the research that would be necessary to make decisions on the piece of legislation. They'll be more active. They'll be lobbied generally by the groups. And so we do find that in the later stages of the legislative process, having a larger coalition from that earlier stage, still having a larger coalition actually does predict some measure of legislative success, which makes sense if you think about just the size of the lobbying coalition that would be active on that piece of legislation.
I think more broadly, I think what the real interesting beginning of this research project that I know we're going to be seeing more of is you're illuminating an early phase of the legislative process. Now, at the Policy Agendas Project, we can do some of the early phase stuff. We got hearings, we've got bills, we've got some things like that. This is occurring before all of that. But ignoring that for a second, most congressional scholarship is done on roll call votes or later stages. What do we learn by shifting that window from the roll call stage to the earlier stage? How does the process look different from where you're looking at it versus when most Congress scholars are looking at it?
I think it's a different set of questions. If you're looking at roll call votes, if you're looking at how members of Congress vote on the bills that come out of Congress, you're looking at, what is the legislation that Congress passes. I think by looking in the earliest stages of the legislative process, by looking at the bills that are introduced, by looking at the bills that get early support, what we're able to do is look at the ideas, the bills, and, even if we go more broadly than just looking at bills, but also looking at these policy letters, the ideas that individual members of Congress are trying to advance without having to worry about the constraints of the leadership's agenda control. So the bills that come up to a vote on the floor are, heavily dictated by what the leadership is willing to allow come up to a vote, whereas there's no such constraint on what bills are introduced or what bills have Dear Colleagues associated with them.
When you gave your job talk almost, 2 years ago at this point, you show this you were showing other parts of this work where you show that there's a lot of cooperation at this early stage. And then even in the modern Congress, but in the modern Congress, once we get to the roll call stage, we get highly polarized, lots of, all of this. And I asked you a question and you didn't answer it the way that I thought you'd answer. And it was so much more, your answer was much more interesting. I said, so why is it breakdown? Where does it break down the process? And your answer was, I expect you to answer, it's all agenda setting. It's all other kinds of stuff. It's all public pressure. But what you said was that a lot of stuff passes in omnibus legislation and voice votes. So it's are we showing Congress being more productive than we think they're being? Is Congress at this stage actually getting a lot of stuff done? And it's really the high profile stuff that we observe polarization on.
So I think that this is an area that requires a lot more study. My intuition is that, yes, that is the answer. That is my – one of the challenges that we have in political science is, or specifically in legislative and studying Congress, is that these bills are frequently incorporated into larger pieces of legislation, and it's not always an omnibus bill. It can frequently be so the Veterans Affairs Committee takes 10 different bills that are – you know, dealing with minor issues and collapses them into a single piece of legislation and sends it to the floor. If you look at the legislative record for those individual bills, they show that they didn't pass because the kind of collection of them did. So in political science, we're just starting to get into kind of tracing these bills through the legislative process when they get incorporated into other pieces of legislation. John Wilkerson at the University of Washington is doing some great work with that. I went to a talk at Southern by a couple of scholars at the University of Michigan and BYU graduate students who are working on something similar. And I think it's really important work. And I think that having that ability to trace bills through other possible avenues of legislative success will allow us to make stronger empirical claims that, yes, Congress is actually getting more done than we think it is. Because right now, the main statistic that we use to kind of try to make that argument is that the length of bills is actually getting longer, even while the number of bills passed reduces, which is, that's messy.
I'll put in a plug for our titles data set, which we released about 5 years ago, 4 years ago. The first data set I worked on here at the Policy Agendas Project, that is, it's used a little bit, but not that much, but it separates those public laws into individual, what are in laws called titles, which can sometimes contain individual bills, can sometimes contain pieces of bills. If anyone's looking for a project, it needs more analysis.
If anything, we hope that this podcast encourages you to come up with new and creative data. And that's what this is. And I think that's the biggest contribution here. The theory is solid. The empirics are really, really sophisticated. It's using really new ways of measuring things. But mostly, this is a data set that is not roll call votes. And that we should all celebrate that.
I love dunking on roll call votes. Is that?
All right, so given all this unorthodox lawmaking that's going on, what does that mean for credit claiming for the interest groups? And what might that mean for the ways that these interest groups are going to endorse in these letters moving forward?
I mean, I think that the idea that credit claiming when it comes to either interest groups or members of Congress requires that a bill with that person's name or organization's name attached to it has to pass just isn't true. I mean, if we think about, especially when we're dealing with the rise of social media, for example, one of the things in the larger project where I'm looking at the collaboration between members of Congress is I draw out a number of tweets and Facebook posts and press releases and other forms of media where members of Congress are claiming credit for having passed legislation that they weren't the like main listed sponsor on because they were the collaborative partner, but they're still claiming it as their own. They're still going out to their constituents and saying, I passed this bill. And I mean, I don't think you can get away with doing that on something that you had no involvement in because someone at some point is going to fact check it. But if I'm working with you on a piece of legislation and I'm helpful to you and then I go back and it passes and I go back to my constituents and said, I passed this bill, presumably, if the hometown newspaper decides to like fact check this because they noticed it didn't match up and they go to you, you would confirm as the bill sponsor, yes, this was a collaborative effort between the two of us.
That's fair. I mean,
I
that
got
makes
off
sense.
The point, I think.
No, that makes a lot of sense. I worry though, right? Like, don't interest groups want to be able to fire up their base too, though,
oh,
right?
Sure.
Like, it's not very exciting to say, like, oh, this one section in this omnibus bill was for us, as it is to say, like, we endorsed this bill. It made it all the way through the process. Everyone appreciates how difficult that is. And, like, that was really good for all of us.
But I think that the messaging tends to be much more on the frame of we got this thing done. So it's less about did we pass the bill, did we not pass the bill. It's like we have done this thing and delivered this good to you, our members. So, you know, the American Farm Bureau you know, they're not going to be able to claim credit for every single piece of a farm bill, for example. You know, they're going to highlight the points that are of particular importance to them and their members, and ignore the parts they don't like when they talk about it.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right, so I think that's going to wrap up questions for this podcast. So as we wrap up the podcast itself, I would love to hear a recommendation from you for a work of political science that you think our listeners should go out and read.
So I just finished rereading for like the fifth time E.E. Schatzsnyder's The Semi-Sovereign People, because I'm teaching it this semester. And one of the things, I mean, I just love that book, but one of the things I was really struck by going through it, it's looking at kind of addressing this question of, you know, who has power in American democracy and the relationships between you know, the role of individual voters and interest groups and leaders all working together. But one of the things I was really struck by going through this, you know, older book is the number of times I was like, wow, that really applies for explaining what's going on right now. It's I think, an incredibly applicable work in a lot of ways.
The chapter in that book that I think is just so under-discussed is the chapter where he asks about how some of these very, very small interest groups can get policy changed. An interest group, I think it was one of the examples he used, it was like the Shoreline Association of Rhode Island or something like that with 300 members. Mm-hmm. And they somehow managed to get a piece of legislation changed and showing that that actual number doesn't matter. What matters is the fight that they're able to draw and the allies they're able to seek. Do you think that this project you're working on, the AJPS article we're talking about now, is an extension of Schatzsnyder? I mean, are you showing? I'm not sure if you cite him in here, but yeah, but theoretically, are you in that tradition where you're looking for essentially groups attracting a crowd for a fight?
You know, I didn't think about it in exactly those terms, but I think that's certainly a fair summary.
All right.
Now I wish I could reframe, you know, kind of the intro a little bit.
There's always the next article.
There's always something else
in
to
print
write.
At the American Journal of Political Science. Allison, thank you very much for joining us. Zach, Christine, thank you for joining us. Liberal Arts and Structural Technology, thank you for producing this podcast. Until next week, this has been your Policy Agendas podcast.